v. Upton. Mr. Kavanaugh.
Good morning, Your Honors. Phil Kavanaugh, Federal Defender, Trial Counsel, and Appellate Counsel for Mr. Upton. May it please the Court. The two issues that I wish to address this morning are the Miranda issue and the trial court's failure to give the lesser-included offense instruction. On the Miranda issue, as the Court is well aware, the totality of the circumstances require an unambiguous and unequivocal waiver of the right to remain silent. In this case, the government has presented their case in the form of you have Miranda, you have talk, and therefore you have to have waiver. But the Supreme Court and the teachings of this Court require that you have Miranda, you have waiver, and then if you talk, it can be held against you. And that's the issue that we're addressing here this morning. In the instant case, the record is pretty clear that Mr. Upton had an altercation with the police, which included being roughed up and having his nose broken.
But in this case, his nose injury wasn't due to a beating related to an interrogation.
No, ma'am, it was prior to the interrogation.
It was a result of his resistance to the arrest and transport. I mean, how would that make him fear that if he failed to answer questions, he would be beaten? I mean, isn't that a fundamentally different situation than those that you're using for comparison here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the reason for that is he had his nose broken. He went to the jail, and then shortly thereafter, he was interrogated by the same officers that participated in the physical altercation at the scene. We're talking about an hour to an hour and a half from the time his nose was broken until he was interrogated at the St. Clair County Jail.
What are they supposed to do, get another team of police to question him?
Well, the issue was that, well, that's what the case law suggests, in fact, Your Honor.
That doesn't make any sense. But so if you violently resist arrest, that entitles you to another team of interrogators?
Not in every case, Your Honor, but the issue turns on this. He's at the county jail. He's been on crack. He's been beat up. Whether he had it coming or not, I'm not going to argue that.
Oh, he had it coming. Yeah, he had it coming.
Okay, he had it coming. He got beat up.
He damaged the car. I mean, he must have been really violent to have bent the door of the car.
Well, he was violent, Your Honor. I can't dispute that.
Yeah, okay, so.
But the point is, the teaching of this court and the Supreme Court says that there has to be an unambiguous waiver of the right to counsel. In this case, the police are in the room with him, and he is trying to talk his way out of the case. At that point, they should have stopped, and they should have gotten a written waiver from him.
What's the ambiguity if he's trying to talk his way out of the case, right? He wants to talk.
He never said that he waived his rights.
Well, what does that mean? He's talking.
But he shouldn't be talking under those circumstances.
He shouldn't be talking. He wants to talk.
He doesn't want to talk about his guilt or innocence. He wants to try to negotiate a deal with the police.
You said he wants to talk his way out of it. The way you talk your way out of it is convince the police that you're innocent, or else, you know, you can turn in a whole bunch of people to them, make it worth their while.
But as the cases identified in the appellant's brief indicate, that the police have an obligation when there's that sort of ambiguity, when there's that sort of...
I don't see what the ambiguity is.
Well, I suggest to the court there is ambiguity here because they have an obligation to make sure that he waives his rights.
That's not a meaningful sentence. There's an ambiguity because they have a duty to, you know, inform him. What is the ambiguity?
That they are required to get...
That's not an ambiguity. A requirement is not an ambiguity. What is the ambiguity here?
The ambiguity is that he wasn't unequivocal about waiving his rights.
Well, unequivocality is the opposite of ambiguity.
Well, he wasn't, Your Honor. He was in a position...
You said he was unequivocal.
He was trying to talk to them about his case, and the police, according to the cases that we've cited in the brief, have an obligation to stop him and get a Miranda waiver from him, which they never bothered to do. They didn't get a written waiver. They didn't audio tape it. They didn't videotape it.
I understand you. If a person just starts talking, I don't see why the police have to shut him up.
Under the circumstances of this case, I suggest to the court that there's that obligation. Because, first of all, he was on crack. That's undisputed. That's in the record.
That's his doing.
Well, it's still his doing, but the police are required to take the suspect as they address them, as they come across them, and they knew this. They knew this from contact with the appellant. They also knew that he was injured. They also knew that he was emotionally distraught. There's evidence of that in the record. So when they go into the room, if they're going to use the same interrogators that participated in the apprehension and the altercation, they should be extra careful and make sure that when Upton wants to talk to them, that he gives up, he knowingly and voluntarily and unequivocally waives his right to remain silent. That isn't present in the case. Now, regarding, if I can move on to the lesser included offense issue, that issue is governed by the cases that we've cited, and also, as the court knows, there's a two-pronged test. In this case, I don't think there's any dispute that possession is a lesser included offense with a possession with intent to distribute.
Does he have a job? Did he have a job? Was he employed?
Did he have a job or was he employed? I don't believe he was employed at the time this occurred.
So where else but from drug dealing was he going to get the money for the drugs?
I didn't ask him, and he didn't tell me.
He didn't ask him. Look, what is he, a scion of great wealth, a Rockefeller?
Well, he was living with a person at the address, and the money could have been part of their shared income. I don't know that.
But he doesn't have any income. You say he doesn't have any lawful income. He's not employed.
He lived there with another person that, and that could have been her money for all I know. That was never addressed in the trial, so I can't answer that.
Could I just ask you this? Under your theory, would the lesser instruction have to be given in every case in which the amount of drugs that is found was consistent with personal use and the alleged user, or I'm sorry, and the alleged dealer was also a user, regardless of how much evidence there is that dealing was occurring at the residence?
Not on that set of facts alone. This is pretty much of a very fact-specific case. And in this case, there was evidence of personal use. It was a relatively small amount of drugs. It wasn't packaged as if for sale. There was a bag of crack and a bag of powder. There was the fact that other persons occupied the home. And there is also facts that the police officers may have conducted a controlled buy, but that never went before the jury. There was no evidence of surveillance. There was no evidence of any other activity to support the concept of drug trafficking, except which was found in the home, and the home was jointly occupied by others.
His history, he is a dealer.
He's done it before, yes, Your Honor, he has. But the jury never heard that. And so for that reason, I think we're entitled to the lesser included offense instruction since there was evidence on the record.
The jury, why didn't the jury hear it?
He never took the stand.
So you're saying he can conceal evidence and use that concealment as the basis for an instruction?
He has the constitutional right to remain silent, Your Honor, and he exercised it in this case because there was evidence adduced both from the government.
See how you can use the Fifth Amendment as a basis for getting an instruction.
No, that's the reason he didn't take the stand, Your Honor. The reason he didn't take the stand was his decision, and that's in the record. He had the right not to testify, and he exercised that right. The evidence in the record which supports the lesser-included offense instruction is there, including the fact that there was more than one person present in the house, including the fact that we're talking a relatively small amount of contraband, including the fact that he admitted he was a user. There was evidence of use in the house. And when he was apprehended by the police, he was outside on the driveway, and the house was locked.
But isn't the problem here that because the trial court found that the defense here was exculpatory, in other words, that the drugs belonged to someone else, I mean, that was his defense, wouldn't that be inconsistent with the defense of simple possession? And isn't that a pretty good reason for a court to deny a lesser included instruction?
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think there was evidence in the record to support the instruction and let the jury have that option. And I point out the fact that they did acquit him of one count of the indictment, so they did mull over the evidence fairly thoroughly. And I suggest to the court that if they had the opportunity to consider the lesser included offense issues, they may have well found him not guilty of the lead charge and found him guilty of the lesser included offense.
See, I'm afraid that the Hill case...
Well, Your Honor, I think you can distinguish Hill on its facts. I really do. We're talking about an individual who took the stand, said he didn't do it, had 73 individually packed bags. The quantity, I think, was almost an ounce. And I think what the court's opinion in Hill was not to award the defendants for what they perceived to be perjury and misleading the jury. And that's the difference in this case.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Crow?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. I think this case, as it relates to the working in turn on the issue that you've most recently been discussing with my opposing counsel, as to the lesser included instruction, this case is most readily distinguished from Hill and DeSoto in as much as what lacked in quantity here as it relates to the controlled substances, and in particular this is by analogy to DeSoto, was more than made up for by way of evidence of distribution that was found within the house.
Yeah, but where you've got a situation where a defendant doesn't take the stand, like here, you know, and deny that the drugs are his, why should Hill preclude a lesser included instruction simply because the defense puts on evidence from which a jury could conclude either that, you know, he possessed the drugs for personal use or that he didn't possess the drugs at all? In other words, where the concern with perjury isn't an issue, why should the use of an alternate defense itself preclude the lesser included instruction?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to address that because the defendant has made much of one statement I made during the jury instruction conference that says that he has to get up and say, and this was not literally, but what I was representing to the district judge at the time was that the defendant must adduce evidence that shows that the amount possessed is not only consistent with possession, but that he also likewise may have possessed these particular drugs. And the district court's finding is very specific on this point, Your Honor, in as much as the court found that while there was evidence that the defendant was a drug user, that there was no evidence presented by the defense by examination of any of the witnesses that did testify that in fact he possessed or used these drugs. And that's also borne out in the context in which he possessed those drugs, which is when viewed by law enforcement upon arrival at his residence in July of 2003 to execute the search warrants, he was on the front lawn or in a truck situated next to the residence and gave flight. He was not in his house where in the bedroom the defense, there only would be evidence of possession is a plate with cocaine residue on it, was located. He's out there with drugs separately packaged, cocaine in one baggie, crack cocaine in another, both packaged within yet another baggie still. And outside a house then that in the kitchen area, which is really the epicenter of the distribution activities, there's found a scale, some 400-plus baggies, marijuana, and cocaine residue on the scale in the kitchen. So the issue, to answer your question, Your Honor, is that we don't have a situation here where the latter part of the hypothetical you pose is fulfilled, and that is there is not evidence that allows a rational jury to conclude that he possessed these drugs simply as opposed to possessing them with intent to distribute them. So that's the distinguishing factor as it relates to both Hill and DeSoto. One point I'd like to make, that Mr. Kavanaugh submits that there is no dispute that this is a lesser included offense as it relates to the crack cocaine, that is. And there is a dispute because the instructions that the defendant tendered are instructions that relate to a violation of Title 21, Section 844A, specifically as to the possession of cocaine base. They don't instruct on the simple possession of a controlled substance and then later instruct that you may take as given or proven that crack cocaine is a controlled substance, but instead they set forth as elements of their instruction, and these are instructions, they're actually 10 and 12. The district judge references 11 and 13 in his findings, but those actually relate to the powder cocaine. But they're contained in the defendant's appendix to his brief, and they specifically relate to crack. And that is the exact type of instruction that was found by Hill to not be proper in this context, in as much as it contains an element above and beyond an element that would be required to be established for a violation of 21 U.S.C. 841 to be proven. So as tendered, and this is the second issue we addressed in our brief relating to the refusal of these instructions, as tendered, these instructions may not be given under the guidance of Hill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning back to the post-arrest statement, several factual issues I'd like to clarify. The appellant concedes in his brief and also in his motion to suppress his statement that in July 2003, at the time of his arrest, he was, quote, stubbornly uncooperative. He admits that he was Mirandized twice, once at the scene in front of his house. He's actually gives flight from his home, is taken into custody at one location, brought back to the residence a few homes away, removed from the vehicle, searched incident to arrest, Mirandized according to the testimony of both Sergeant Eversman and Investigator Bedard, who are later present in the interrogation room. He then goes on, is transported in the original vehicle he was secured in by a Cahokia police officer, which is a separate agency from the agency that was executing the search warrant, and it's during that transport that he acts up and tries to kick out the squad car door. At no point, however, Your Honors, was there any evidence, either in the suppression hearing or at trial, that his nose was broken. The clear evidence is, and it's reflected, and I believe it's Government's Exhibit 2, in the booking photo of the defendant, that he had a laceration on the bridge of his nose that is consistent with the testimony of Officer Phil Taylor, the Cahokia officer who was involved in the transport and who ultimately wound up striking him with an open palm in the face as he attempted to resecure the defendant in a vehicle where he was trying to also kick that officer. The defendant alleges this both in his initial brief and in his reply brief, but Taylor clearly stated that he was not sure if Upton was diagnosed with a broken nose or not. Moreover, as it relates to the defendant's assertions that he...
Does it matter here?
It doesn't, Your Honor, but it's a factual extreme that the defendant trots out as converting this, what is really just a legitimate use of force in securing a defendant in a squad car, into a would-be beating, and he's trying to do that to escalate it, to pull it within the purview of some of the cases that do deal with perhaps excessive force, but that nevertheless vitiate a subsequent waiver of Miranda, even where no written Miranda waiver was provided by the defendant. It's a point I'd like to address as it relates to the case that the defendant cites in his reply brief. I believe it's the Stawicki v. Israel case. In that case, during transport, the defendant refuses to sign a written waiver and says something to the effect of, I ain't got nothing to say to you, and then later makes statements that are found to be the product of a knowing and willing waiver of Miranda. I think, as Judge Posner pointed out quite correctly, this is a defendant who, according to the testimony of Sergeant Eversman, who was in the interview room, wanted to give up other people. He wanted to cooperate. He was trying to show that he could give up, quote-unquote, according to the testimony, bigger fish. And in his attempts to do that, he was trying to give them statements to show that he wasn't the person that they were after, and in so doing, made inculpatory statements. But Investigator Bedard's testimony is unequivocal that Miranda was administered at the site at which the defendant was searched incident to arrest and again in the room. The defendant makes much of the fact that the interview was not videotaped, but there's evidence in the record through the trial transcript that that was not the policy or practice of that agency at the time, and a practice that didn't come into being until the following year. The defendant suggests that had he been provided medical treatment, that somehow would have made better the Miranda waiver, but clearly he was administered first aid and did not ask for any medical treatment, and Philip Taylor's testimony is unequivocal on that point, that had he requested it, their policy would have been to summon an ambulance to have him treated. Moreover, the investigators in the interview room, their statements are quite clear that this is not a person who is evidencing any reluctance to give statements. He was, according to Sergeant Eversman, pacing about the room during the questioning, trying to convince them of his willingness to cooperate with them. And moreover, as it relates to the considerations that have been found to be proper...
Wasn't he lying on the floor weeping?
That was, Your Honor, that was the testimony that regarded that was at the Cahokia police station where the defendant was first transported to await subsequent transfer to the St. Clair County Jail where he was ultimately questioned. So that was after the transport by Philip Taylor. He was held at Cahokia Police Department, and then he was later transported by an investigator named Bill Kenny, who also testified about that transport to the jail. He was then pulled from his jail cell by Investigator Bedard and brought up to an interview room where he was interviewed by Investigator Bedard, Sergeant Eversman, and another officer named Gary Brewer. So that is once removed, that he was apparently despondent there, but apparently knew Bill Kenny when he showed up to pick him up and transport him to St. Clair County. Moreover, there was testimony that Mr. Upton was asking specifically to speak with Sergeant Eversman, the person who was ultimately in the interview room. So his familiarity with law enforcement is not just broad in nature and as it relates to the considerations relevant to a Miranda consideration, but rather he specifically asked to speak with these individuals. I submit, therefore, Your Honors, especially after the lengthy suppression hearing, the monumental amount of evidence that was amassed over those 2 days, and the detailed order issued by the district court, that the suppression of his statement would hardly be appropriate given the facts of this case, and the district court did not err in allowing that into evidence.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Cavanaugh, your time expired. You can have a minute if you like. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We thank the defenders for their efforts on behalf of Mr. Upton.